part two of the introduction of astrology for artists. When those old codgers who invented astrology, we don't really know who they are, but they did, someone did, came up with the whole system, Cancer and Leo were placed at the heart of the zodiac. Now, it's a round system, and we wouldn't know that if we start counting from the sign Aries, because we come to Cancer as the fourth sign and Leo as the fifth. And we wouldn't know it if we use the theme of Monday, where we have Cancer as the first sign and Leo as the second sign. But if we focus in and look at Leo and Cancer, we see the two signs that are ruled by the luminaries, the moon in the case of Cancer, and the sun in the case of Leo. And Leo rules the heart. That is its role, and its ruling planet is the sun. And in a little while, on August 15th, there's going to be this glorious conjunction of Venus and the sun in Leo, and Mars is going to be in Leo. And so there is this focus on the heart of the zodiac. Now, part of how we know it's the heart of the zodiac is that, and that would count along with Cancer, because we need a cooler water sign and a hotter fire sign, and we have accounted for the moon and the sun. But to one side of this pairing is Virgo, which is a sign ruled by Mercury. And to the other side of this pairing is Gemini, a sign ruled by Mercury as well. So we have the sun and the moon in the middle, and then to each side of them we have a Mercury-ruled sign. And if we keep counting out, we have, moving out, next to Gemini is Taurus, which is a Venus-ruled sign. Next to Virgo is Libra, also a Venus-ruled sign. Next to Libra is Scorpio, a Mars-ruled sign. Next to Taurus is Aries, a Mars-ruled sign. Next to Scorpio is Sagittarius. That's a Jupiter-ruled sign. And next to Aries is Pisces. That is a Jupiter-ruled sign. And what that leaves are two final signs, and they are Capricorn and Aquarius, and they are ruled by Saturn. So if we start at the heart of the matter and we work our way out, we see this elegant system, but deep at the core heart of the matter is Leo to one side and Cancer to the other side. Now, there's not much happening right now in the sign Cancer, and most of what's going on is going on in Leo, again, the sign that rules the heart. And I want to describe a bit of what existence might feel like if lived spontaneously from that place, that fifth place of the zodiac, which is also the core of the zodiac. And I've got my list of associations on this kind of free associations on this topic. And what I'm going to do is just read those randomly and kind of riff on them and splash around the ideas and see where this goes. Okay, so here we go. Okay, right across the top of the page, I have the words written, serious play. That's a good blend of fifth and sixth house qualities, because we get the serious quality of the sixth and the playful quality of the fifth. And serious play is the thing that mostly children know about. This is a mode of play that is in the child mind much more than in the adult mind. Now, it is in the adult mind when someone has declared themselves an artist. There is the serious play of music rehearsal. There is the serious play of designing something, the serious play of doing any craft work, for example, where it is play, but it's also got an atmosphere of this is meaningful and I'm doing this to play, but also because it's meaningful. Across the top of this copy of my free association is written a spirit of experimentation being essential to this heart of the matter, along with serious play. Now, on another parallel copy of this thing that I've got, that I was more portable than the one in the kind of 12 by 16 notebook. I have written resistance and restrictions in past injuries. So with resistance, I think it's always helpful to recognize the fact that in creative process, resistance happens. Resistance has many origins and many sources. And one of them is restrictions that have been put on us and being told very young that you can't sing or that you can't draw or that, it's taking too much time. You should be doing more important things like studying. And these can accumulate as past injuries. I have a friend of mine who's a very bright, talented guy named Mike Ackerman, and he recently, a mutual friend told me that he put the story of this up on his Facebook page of he wanted a harmonica when he was little, young, like under 10 years old. And so his mother bought him a harmonica back in the day when they were like, you know, a couple of bucks for a nice Hohner harmonica. And he starts playing it and playing along with the radio in the car. And he really gets into it, so much so that his lips start to bleed, which is a fairly common thing that happens when people are new with the harmonica. And his mother got really upset about this and thought, what kind of a thing is this? I'm not going to have my son playing this thing that makes his lips bleed, and took it back to the store, returned it, and that ended his harmonica career. I had a similar experience of getting a banjo, which I wanted more than anything in the world, when I was maybe about 13 years old, and it had a fret that buzzed. And instead of getting the thing set up, which I now know as an adult is what you do, you take the instrument to a music shop and you get it set up, he took it back to the store, and that was the end of it. And it was this beautiful, it was really the banjo of my dreams, and that dream ended. And that was the first of many musical injuries that I have had to keep overcoming day by day. So when there is resistance, you may want to look to a past injury for that. And those are gumption traps. And part of what you're healing is that past injury. A lot of people have musical injuries. They had bitchy piano teachers who made them feel like they were terrible. Or stupid. My piano teacher, Mrs. Silvers, when I would make a mistake, she would say, "You're composing." And that's now a joke in music class with Dan, because we who actually understand music know that part of the composition process is making a mistake. That is the that is the nature of the thing. It's a perfect oblique strategy. Use a mistake to compose, but you know, it's so good to do it that you just kind of want to make mistakes and see where they lead you. And so that lets you hang a little bit looser and in some ways work past your resistance to do that. Okay, so back to copy one, the concept of talent. Okay, here's a huge misunderstanding about existence. Yeah, there is such a thing as talent, but I don't really know what it is. It seems to me more like practice, experimentation, devotion, putting in time, giving yourself the chance to do something and then really doing it. That's more like talent. And there must be, it's just so hard to understand what this thing is. But I wonder, and it drives people crazy because they think, I don't have the talent to do that. I'm not, good enough to do that. I'm not talented. And that, I think I hear people say that and they're just talking themselves out of doing something that they want to do. And it's the same with the concept of creative. I was sitting in Dominic's cafe doing my experiment in orange, which I'll be happy to share with you. And Dominic says, "Oh, you're so creative." And I'm thinking, really, all I'm doing is just coloring this piece of paper yellow and orange and then using a colorless pencil to smash the colors together. Didn't feel very creative to me, but to him, it seemed creative. To me, it seemed like I was just experimenting with the feeling of yellow and orange. So I'm going to make a note here. And I'd be happy to share all manner of art experiments as part of this, make a little gallery up. So the concept of talent and the concept of creative, I think, are, they may exist, but I'm gonna put them in the I don't know column, because it so often happens that people who just experiment and let themselves do things without judging end up judging themselves, the harshest judgment there is, end up talking themselves out of, well, the ones who don't judge get somewhere. Something creative comes out spontaneously or experimentally, and the ones who get caught up in this pattern of self-judgment generally close themselves off, having taken on the role of oppressor or having assigned it to someone else, like a boyfriend who says that you can't do that when really it's no one's business but your own. But let's look up the word talent in the etymology dictionary and see where that leads us. All right, so this is my favorite dictionary, one of my favorite web pages. Talent. Oh, you're going to like this. Noun, late 13th century. It means inclination, disposition, will, desire. So it is a confluence. And by the way, a 700-year-old word. Inclination, disposition, will, and desire. From Old French, talent. From medieval Latin, talenta, plural of talentum. Inclination, leaning, will, desire. In classical Latin, balance, weight, sum of money. From Greek, talenton, a balance, a pair of scales, hence weight, definite weight, anything weighed. And in later times, a sum of money. From Proto-Indo-European root, P-I-E, capital, pi, P-I-E, tele, to lift, support, weigh. With derivatives referring to measured weights, thence money and payment. Wow. An ancient denomination of weight, originally Babylonian, though the name is Greek, varying widely in value among different peoples at different times. Ha ha. True that. According to Little and Scott, as a monetary sum considered to consist of 600 drachma, or in Attica, 57.75 pounds of silver. That's a lot of silver. Also borrowed in other Germanic languages and one talent was 57.75, nice number, pounds of silver, attested in Old English as talente. The medieval Latin and common Romanic sense developed from figurative use of the word in the sense of money, meaning special natural ability, aptitude, gift, committed to one for use and improvement, presumably for money, that's my comment, developed by mid-15th century, perhaps in part figurative sense, wealth, but mostly from the parable of the talents in Matthew 25:14-30, meaning persons of ability collectively, from 1856. Good heavens. Adrian Rich once said, a language is a map of our failures. I believe that's in a poem called The Burning of Paper Instead of Children. So I'll link to this on the list of anti resources. But let's just stick with inclination, disposition, will, desire. Okay, for 700 years, that's been the basic approach. And I think that, well, anyway, it's no excuse to say, oh, I don't have talent. If you have the inclination, the leaning, the will, or the desire, you have the talent. Okay, initiative, intentionality. So this is what I've got in my original scribbling out of notes. Initiative, intentionality. That sounds like the inclination, disposition thing. Awareness, sensory, persistence. So I've got a confluence of being aware as being part of the heart of the matter, aware of what your senses are giving you, and a persistent use of awareness of the senses, i.e. being awake, not walking down the street faced forward with your head rigid like you have your neck in a neck brace, not looking at anything or anyone, but rather turning your head and looking persistently at everything and anyone that gets your eye. One of the things I learned when I did my second major. Well, I've got a long history with photography, which ended part one, lengthy part one, ended with a flood from Hurricane Floyd in 1999, and resumed in 2005 when I purchased my first digital camera on 1/20/05, the day that Bush was inaugurated for the second term. I was living in Paris, and I started taking pictures regularly. And so instead of looking around saying, oh, that would make a great picture, that would make a great picture, suddenly I was taking pictures. Now, for me, photography 1.0 was mainly photojournalism. I was a very handy editor in that I could just go out and come back with a cover photo of something, but never really, rarely, occasionally, but almost never, took a photo for the sake of making beauty. Photography 2.0, digital, post-flood, recovered camera, I'll check that chart for the Bush inauguration, I'll set it for Paris, was it photography for beauty, photography for the sake of, let's see what this looks like, Paris being the perfect place, a very visual place. And so what I learned from doing that was that I was learning to see. I was learning to look at the world and eat the world with my eyes and see everything. And there is a taboo on this. You're not supposed to look at everything and everyone. You're not supposed to be studying and quote-unquote staring. And I'm often interested in studying the visual impact of women on my mind and my emotions and other sensory organs. And this is a granting oneself permission. So I granted myself permission to basically eat the world with my eyes. And I'm aware that this can be offensive to some people to be looking at that which I want to look at. And I just said, I'm an artist. I'm a photographer. It is a visual art. Therefore, I will grant myself permission to look at anyone or anything I want to look at, and that's it. And if you don't like it, you can stop looking at me, looking at that, and go drink your coffee. Okay, so giving yourself permission to be persistently aware of what your senses are delivering. Next note, openness, honesty, to present. Well, to see the world in a visceral way or feel the world and then to depict the world and then offer that in presentation in any way requires a degree of honesty, which means being open. There's a transparency, which implies the next line, vulnerability and sensitivity. And then my next free association is the naked page, facing the blank page, which could lead to an interesting discussion of tattoos, because people with tattoos don't really get to experience their body blank. They're never really naked. If you have especially a lot of tattoos, you're always dressed in your tattoos. And to face the naked page over and over again is vulnerable. It requires you to meet the world from all of your potential all at once. Be anything ending up on that page. Ownership of your experience, claiming ownership of your journey through life and of your experience of life on Earth. Child versus adult states. This is from transactional analysis originally, but that's what I've got there. Child versus adult states. Now, this is worth looking at in transactional analysis, whether you, there's lots of basic books on transactional analysis. It's likely that Wikipedia will offer you something, and there is an astrology book on transactional analysis. Now, let's see. I'm no longer that good at just grabbing the right astrology book off the shelf, but let me take a look and see if I can get you the title of that book while it's fresh in my mind. Okay, I can't find it, but I believe it's called Astrology and the Games People Play. Games People Play being one of the very most famous books on transactional analysis, well worth reading, because Games People Play is a study in the psychological games people play to eat up their creativity and their intimacy. And as part of the study of the psyche in transactional analysis, which is kind of a lengthy descendant of Freudian psychology, made more accessible, there are the child state, there's the child state, the adult state, and the parent state. And the child state wants to experience life as the fifth house all the time, taking risks, playing, experimenting. And the parent state wants to shut that down. And the adult state is able to create the mental and physical structure to allow the child state to have expression. And so what you're really looking for as an artist is a combination of the adult state and the child state. And to get the parent state out of the picture, because the parent state is not interested really in making art. If it is, it's not really the parent state, it's the adult state. All right, state meaning state of mind, and then state of mind being something that just takes over the whole psyche. That's the power of a mental state, is it becomes primary identification. Okay, resourcefulness. So part of art and the self-creative state of being is about basically being resourceful, but using everything as a resource. Everything is potentially a source of an idea. And the adult state hates, rather the parent state hates this. The adult state might see the wisdom in this, and the child state is free associating all the time. Everything is the possession of the child through the senses and perception. I'm sure great poets have written about this. Rimbaud comes to mind, of how a child sees the world as everything in the senses is its to sense, to perceive. And part of that resourcefulness is gathering things and stitching them together. And this is why sometimes art and photo studios are such crazy collections of objects, is because anything is a potential source of inspiration, of an idea, of a thing. And perhaps there's a fine line between that and hoarding. But in reality, it is necessary to collect and experiment and let everything touch off some inspiration in your mind, in your feelings, or certainly to be open to it. And that's part of being resourceful. And another part of resourceful is how are you going to fund your project? How are you going to make time in this busy, crazy world to do this? How are you going to create the resource of the room that you need to do this creative art therapy healing process project that is really about finding yourself? That's all part of resourcefulness. Okay, and there's many other ways. Depth, basic thing is that art and the creative state and the self-creative state involve going deeper into perception than we are typically allowed to go in the world. We're not really socially encouraged to be deep. People get annoyed and they tell us that we're full of it, and why are you overthinking this? And really, you're just seeing past the surface appearance of things and looking for, wow, what is that? That's a beautiful dress. What is the statement that it's making? Oh, that person reminds me of something. What is it that person reminds me of? So that's depth, and it's also part of awareness. Bravery. Mm-hmm. This is a brave thing to do, to see the world this way. It is brave to be deep when everyone else wants to be shallow. It is around you. It is brave to need solitude when everyone else just wants to stay with people and hang out and get drunk. This all requires a real measure of bravery, and don't forget it. If you're finding that your gumption is going somewhere, the thing is bravery, and another word for bravery is courage, which has the French word cœur at the heart of the word courage. And so courage really means heartfulness. Being brave means being hearty. Okay, process. Creativity and self-creativity and living creatively is a process. this may be the most meaningful thing. There is a an ongoing experiment wherein everything is basically a work in progress. You are the work in progress, really, and you are the experiment, really. But to understand that there is a process where ideas are formed, where they are spawned, where they germinate, where they grow, and then, you know, just like running a hothouse operation, you have the place where you sprout the seeds and the place where the sprouts grow to a certain size, and then the sprouts are moved to a certain thing, to maybe a hydroponic tank. And then from there, they're planted outside. And this is a process. There is a growth process. And this is a reminder to engage process as a conscious thing. Now, sprouting off of that, I have the use of time. That's fun. The use of time is really, 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 really important. We got a letter from someone. We used to get mad about letters like this, but someone canceled their subscription to Planet Waves. Who knows, maybe they're listening now because, you know, these are the kind of people who would benefit from this. But she wrote and she said, you know, the reason why, she's assuming we're not doing well, we're doing pretty well, you're not doing well is because your stuff is too long and you don't realize that we are all time poor. She used the expression time poor. So I got this email and bounced it around to my colleagues here at Planet Waves, and, you know, temporal poverty, not having enough time. All right, so how much time do we waste, really? A lot, I think. A lot of time. I know how much time I waste, and I know how much I get done. How about if you don't get anything done? How much time do you waste? I mean, commuting? That's like, really, people commute 2 to 4 hours a day sometimes? That's incredible. Now, there might be a good reason for it, but is there an alternative to commuting 2 to 4 hours a day? And what would you do if you had that time back? Would you even notice? So the use of time, the structuring of time, by the way, a concept that's prominent in transactional analysis, that one of the things central to mature relationships and intimacy is the ability to structure time, to use time well, to set aside time for a purpose, to be devoted, and to use time as a kind of shelter rather than as a kind of an onslaught. This is an art in itself. It could be a good book in the art of time. All right. So now, where do we go? Use of time. All right. Judgment. That's right underneath the use of time, you'll see on this little sketch. Judgment means, well, there's two real basic forms of judgment. One is judging things. That's not good. That's not good. That's good. That's not good. And the other one is having sufficient judgment to be able to accomplish something, to say, to evaluate, basically, and to say, let's try that. That's a form of judgment. Divination. That's there. Sex, S-E-X, essential to this whole process. Somewhere in this could get easily a whole audio, and who knows if I won't give it one as part of this series, but let's just say that sex is essential to the creative process because sex is the creative process because people are created by sex, including lesbians who use turkey basters. Because even if you use turkey baster, it is sexual reproduction. The sperm meets the egg. If you do it in a test tube without any penis or vagina around, sperm meets egg, and that is creative through sexual process. So all creativity has as its origin sexual process of some kind. Beethoven and Laurie Anderson and Chopin and Cyndi Lauper and everybody, all those groovy people, Madame Curie and all them, and Golda Meir and President Obama, we're all created by sex. That means that the Mona Lisa comes from sex, and the assembly line invented by Henry Ford comes from sex, and Buckminster Fuller and all of his inventions come from sex because someone fucked and Bucky Fuller was born. And so the creative power of sex is essential to respect, and it is about much more than making babies. As somebody I once worked with said, you know, procreation is about more than making babies. Procreative thought is creative thought. Procreative action is creative action. And sexual relationships make things. They need to make things. They need to have their creative power harnessed to make things, because sex makes karma. And it's good to know the karma of the people that you're having sex with and to have some sense of that. Or alternately, if that's not an option, if you choose to have sex in the first 15 minutes, to be able to set creative intention. And I assure you that many people don't get how important this is to intentionally set the intention to create and ask yourself what it is you want to create. Besides Mutual Admiration Society and Coochie Coo and Good Time and Candlelight Dinner, which may be enough, but sex is more powerful than that. It's going to create something. And if that something is not creative per se, likely to become destructive. Okay, patience. Very important. Do I need to say more? This whole thing takes patience, especially if you're like old and creaky like me, and it takes you a year to learn the pentatonic scales and so forth. And you got to have patience. You got to come back to it, and you got to come back to whatever you're doing, which means come back to yourself over and over again so that you are, you know, patient. And the reward of patience, as someone said, is more patience, one of those Catholic saints. But I have a feeling that was used against people more than anything. But anyway, it does seem to be true. Okay. Curiosity. Very important. Curiosity is the food of creativity. I think that allowing yourself, stoking your curiosity, stokes your creativity. And as I learned from a client who was involved in the path work, sexual curiosity is the highest form of curiosity. If you want to be curious and therefore creative, fan the flames of your sexual curiosity. Be curious about whoever and whatever you want, especially about how you feel and about who people are. Let that guide you. Curiosity, it did not kill the cat. That this one expression has done more to kill curiosity. It is a vicious expression. I'd like to fact check where that bullshit came from. I may have done that. But curiosity is essential, and it is the thing that defines the child state, is curiosity. Curiosity is the desire to explore, the desire to experiment, the desire to know what's inside that door. I've got this dog friend named Jonah Kelly Francis, and one of his things, he's a dachshund, and dachshunds have a thing always. It might be digging up and burying rocks all day long, and one of Jonah's things is doors. He wants to know what's inside that door. So I let Jonah be my kind of curiosity tour guide, and one night, there was an election. It was a Tuesday night in November. It was the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, and there was an election. And I was out with Jonah at about midnight roaming around, and the Board of Elections, which is on my block or one block over, was open because I live right in the heart of the county seat. And we walked in, and all the ladies working at the Board of Elections were like, "Oh, he's so cute. He's so cute." So I let Jonah lead me around the entire Board of Elections office complex. Nobody was stopping me, and I just let him do it. And I knew that it was just Jonah being curious after all. You never really want the siren to stop in front of your house. That one just did. Okay. So Jonah's roaming around the Board of Elections, and we finally get to the back room where all the ballots are with like red markers on them. And then the lady said, "Nope, can't go back there." But we explored and saw every room in the Board of Elections, thanks to Jonah being curious. Child state. Curiosity is essential to self-creative and art therapy type living, to any form of art. Boredom. Idle time. Live without dead time, said the Situationist. If you read Adbusters, they're talking about this. Vivez sans temps mort. Do not let your mind be dead. People who are bored have a little problem with their curiosity. And if you are bored, get curious and live your curiosity. Boredom is a conditioned state. It is the state of having your mind and your senses and your friendliness and your desire to know people and things and places and feelings and colors and sounds and smells be blocked from you. So note boredom, replace it with curiosity. Intuition, that's a good one. Intuition. Intuition, well, that's the kind of oblique strategies, right? That's the use of an intuitive tool or your intuition itself to guide you, to follow the flow of events. This intuition is not instinct, by the way. Instinct is a much more tangible thing than intuition. Intuition is sublime. It's subtle. It's seeing a color that doesn't exist. It's having a feeling that you're not sure what it is. Intuition, very helpful in the self-creative process. Contact. This is all about contact with yourself, with the world, with others. Contact. And this concludes one of the two pages that I have written about this. This is the kind of first free association of what it's about. What this whole heart of the matter is. I may do a riff on the second part. I'm going to be doing a lot of recording. I've got now 12, at least 12 recordings left, and who knows, I might toss in an extra one on the page with more phrases written. For example, art is not idle time. You allow yourself to explore. And one of the problems with the way that art is treated, any creative expression, whether it's even reading or writing or drawing or, you know, any form of creative experimentation, is it's viewed by boring people as being idle time. And what I mean by art is not idle time is that it is very good use of time, very healing. To work in art. I'll tell you, I'll close with one story, which is since 1992, on and off, I've worked with a guy named Joseph Trousseau in Woodstock, 845-679-7421. He does remote sessions, and he's worth traveling to, worth the trip. And so Planet Waves was in a massive transition in February of 2015, a lot going on, and personnel changes looming on the horizon and financial problems and me being totally overstressed with my work and not really being a happy camper. And so called up Joe and I said, listen, I'm going to come and do a session. And I ended up doing basically a session a week for like 16 weeks. So given that I really have internalized the whole Gestalt philosophy and a lot of what I learned from Joe, that's a lot of sessions. I haven't done that many sessions since like maybe 1994, 1993. Okay, so we really start to weed through what's going on. But one of the first things he said was, listen, and this is someone who's known me a long time and has accomplished many things with his creativity, including helping hundreds of people, thousands of people in the world. He said, you're an artist, and the purpose of Planet Waves is to support your art. How about that? Thought about that a lot. And when I walked in there, I didn't really feel like much of an artist. And we've now taken a break because Joe's going on vacation, I'm about to. So we're taking a little hiatus in our weekly meetings. But at the end of those 16 weeks, most of my notes were being taken in a gigantic sketch pad on which pages were being laid many layers of ink and paint and pencil and compounds to seal the various pages, and everything that I have touched pretty much has been sketched on, colored in, and painted. And I am exploring and experiencing my visual and sensory ability and my desire to create beauty. And what I started to realize was doing, I went through a phase, which I'm still in, of working in colored pencils. So I've got like every kind of colored pencil that I could find, and a good few black and black ones, is that the experience of really getting deep into color and texture and doing things like spending 2 hours on matching like the line between one color field and another color field was changing my orientation on life. The ability to stretch out into that space where the one thing that mattered was the way that pigment was being laid down on the paper. Not the message of the work, not the syntax or grammar or proofreading or the budget or anything, but the sensation of that color and my reaching for the feeling I was looking for in the color fields matching, lining up with one another, where all that mattered was form and feeling. And what I figured out was, experience was, this was changing my worldview. It changed my whole experience of writing. It started to change my experience of music. And I realized this is great. This is something to do. And one day, not that long ago, I was sitting in my chair in Joe's office. And I moved over to the couch and I brought my notebook in to show him what I was doing, just to give him a look at that part of my mind. And he mentioned that he was the studio assistant to a guy named, an abstract expressionist named Jenkins. And this may have come up when I wrote the check on a Jenkins book that was laying around the counseling room. And he mentioned that he was the studio assistant and his job was to prepare the canvases, which is a very important part of Jenkins' work. And in the next session, I'm sitting on the couch and showing him my notebook. And I looked up at the painting on the wall above the couch that I had been looking at on and off since 1992. And I said, "You painted that, right?" And he said, "Yep." Like, fuck, it didn't even occur to me that among the numerous things that he does very well was painting. And I'm looking at the paint and we're talking about the technique and how he painted one layer and then painted another layer, but diluted the paint so that when it dried, it would split. The pigment would split because there was not enough pigment to cover the first layer and created this beautiful effect. Like, I've got to get my hands into this stuff. So I bought my first bottle of gesso, this canvas preparation, and have dived into this sensation of form and feeling and just letting myself play and stretch into this place. And I will tell you that there are a few things I've ever done in my life that have changed my world view and experience of the sensory world more beautifully. So I leave you on that note. And let me go, I'm going to jump down to my downstairs office and fetch up my oblique strategies card. Since we began on the oblique strategy card of make a brick, not a wall. Now we've made two nifty little bricks and we're almost 2 hours into this lovely kind of art therapy process. I'm going to go fetch those cards and see what oblique strategies has to say. So I'll be right back. Okay, after a brief digital instant, which included my dog's convincing me to take them outside, though I didn't have my shoes. But when Jonah runs, he likes to hang out in the music counseling investigative reporting room, bolts down the stairs and gets to the bottom of the stairs and is running in circles, which is what dogs do when they're happy, especially Jonah. Take him out. Okay, so oblique strategies cards. Now, I can't believe that I have not had these cards in my hands till today. after all these years of lighting my creative flame and being guided by, in many ways, the creative ideas and talents of Brian Eno. By the way, his co-author is Peter Schmidt. So first, a correction. The card that I drew, the first card, is not building a wall, but making a brick. So this is works on a few different levels. Not building a wall, but making a brick. So that's oblique strategy card one of my whole life, and the one that sort of solved the puzzle of astrology for artists. And I'm planning on indulging this method generously for the astrology for artists project. Shuffling. Very nice cards. Solid black on the back. A little bit larger and thicker than playing cards. All right. Let's see where we are now. Question the heroic approach. Do you know what he means by that? The heroic approach is the I'm going to save you approach. We love the heroic approach in Western culture, and we want, you know, we use the word hero. You know, it's used all the time, every day. Is John McCain a hero? Is he not a hero? What's a hero? Is every cop and ambulance driver a hero? And every, you know, football player is a hero, and surgeons are heroes, and president's a hero, and everyone's got to be a hero. And this is a whole philosophy that guides our society and contained mythologically in the story of Heracles. That's really the hero's journey is told by the ancient Greeks. So the card says, question the heroic approach. Note, it does not say the heroic approach is wrong or bad. It just says question the heroic approach. And so the question is, is this necessary? Is there another way to do things? Might we use the heroic approach and try another approach? But let's leave that question open. Good thing to do with some questions is to leave them open so you can, you know, get a more interesting answer. As we move forward through what some do describe as the hero's journey of the astrological wheel, and who knows if I'll ponder this, but it might be fun to follow the sign order of the Thema Mundi, which really is about starting the discussion from the sign Cancer, not from the sign Aries. And while we're on the subject, the advent of the Thema Mundi and seeing this thing called the chart of the world, which is pretty much what that means, is it opens up the possibility that there is something other than the heroic approach. I think we could all agree that a sign called Aries, named for the god of war, ruled by Mars, Aries, the god of war, would certainly be the Heracles-like beginning of the hero's journey, with the hero represented by Mars. And that if we shift that 90 degrees and we start the story with the sign Cancer, we have an image of humanity, of the world, and of existence that's about nourishment. The moon doesn't ever conquer anything. The moon provides light, and it provides balance, and it marks a cycle. But unlike, you know, the hero's journey, the moon is about nourishing the family, nourishing the self, nourishing the tribe. And it may be interesting to, you know, start there as a matter of questioning the hero, the heroic approach. All right. Well, thank you, Brian Eno and Peter Schmidt. And let me add the oblique strategies to the list of resources. There's an online version, but these cards are nifty. I've got like every deck ever made, just about a couple. I'm missing a couple, but I have a feeling this may become my deck because it's a beautiful thing. All right, so well, now it's 6:48. It's time to feed the dog friends, and Daniel Sternstein, my music teacher, is on his way over. And we are off to a fabulous start of Astrology for Artists, and I will remanifest, most likely, in one of the astrological signs, and I will catch you there, and that will be in no more than a digital instant. Bye for now.